Welcome to the 46th episode of the ClassCast podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Tibbins. Today, we'll be speaking with Taylor Freeman,
the co-founder of Upload
and the founder and CEO of Axon Park. Taylor is a leader in the virtual reality, augmented reality, sort of XR space. And what's really interesting here is not only that he has expertise in the field of virtual reality as a technology, but he focuses on how to apply those technologies in education and to help training both, we'll let you clarify, but through schools, through universities, government, private industry, et cetera. As I was thinking about how to prepare for this, I the more I thought, the bigger the idea got, because I think the applications someday will be essentially limitless, right? But we're not there yet. So that was where it was a little tough for me to figure out how do we get the ball rolling on this talk, because we could really reach far for this, you know, and not really hit an endpoint for possible applications. So Taylor, thank you for taking the time to talk. And how wrong am I about that? You know, how wrong am I about applying virtual reality? How far away are we, and how is your work going?
Yeah, well, first, thank you so much for having me on the show. Big fan. And, you know, I don't think you're wrong. I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there that have been saying, this is the year of VR. This is the year of VR since, you know, this consumer wave kind of kicked off with Oculus's sale to Facebook. But, you know, it is a slow and steady climb. Just like any new technology sort of follows that Gartner hype cycle. And right now we're seeing a really, you know, positive trend with the new Oculus Quest 2 headset that was just released about a week ago. Some developers are saying that they've seen a 10x increase in their sales just over this past window of the release of the headset, which is incredible because they're already, you know, doing 3 million in sales. So they're 10xing that, which is, that's, you know, very significant. So, you know, there really is a market that is becoming, you know, very clear for this technology on the consumer side. And also within the enterprise, the training space is really taking off right now. You're seeing a lot of applications across pretty much every industry and a lot of value. Clear studies coming out showing that it's improving retention, showing that it's improving, of course, the cost of having a physical trainer versus having virtual training. And so it's a very, very exciting time for the industry.
So given the recent boost, and you know, I've done a little bit of reading trying to make sure I could keep up with you a little bit in the conversation here, but you know, I'm probably not tracking week to week, maybe the way you are. So I've seen, you know, sort of there's this growth over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, and people have been talking about it for a while, like you said. What's your perception? I don't know if there's research that would substantiate this yet, but what's your perception of the effect of the pandemic on virtual reality, with more people working from home, doing school from home? Do you think that that's maybe one of the things that's giving a little boost just right now, like in the short term?
Yeah, great question. It certainly is. It certainly is. You're seeing the usage of VR going up across, you know, all different sectors. And, you know, a lot of these social applications, especially are seeing, you know, tremendous use. People are being, you know, forced into social isolation. You know, that can be a really challenging thing, not having an opportunity to socialize. And these experiences like VR chat or Rec Room, or any of these social VR applications are taking off right now. And they're just seeing tremendous growth. And they're truly fulfilling that need for social connection. You know, there's, of course, the whole debate of, you know, physical connection is incredibly difficult to replicate. And, you know, I don't think that VR is anywhere near replacing in-person true connection, but it really can satisfy that desire and that need to have social connection. So, you know, on the social side, we've seen tremendous growth. On the gaming side, we've seen tremendous growth. And it's kind of the perfect storm with the new headset coming out for $299, you know, all in one unit. You just get this thing, turn it on, and it works. Whereas you think about even 2 years ago, you know, having that experience, the same quality experience with, you know, hand tracking and positional tracking and, you know, high resolution displays, that was at least $2,000 investment. And, you know, you were tethered to your computer and you had to have trackers installed on your walls. And it's just been really remarkable watching the progression.
So, I mean, with that, with the rate of growth, in a moment, I'll talk about sort of how I got onto this idea and ultimately ended up contacting you. But maybe before we get there, a part of that was that, you know, I remember when I was finishing high school, I graduated high school in 2001. And I remember someone having a discussion about how someday you won't even have to go to school. You'll just, you know, it'll all be online. And at that point, the only real frame of reference I had for that was like old correspondence courses. Or I remember seeing like a movie in like elementary school about how kids in the Australian Outback did school by like AM radio or something, you know? And I was like, ah, that's never going to happen. Or it'll happen, but it won't even be during my lifetime. And now, you know, 20 years later, less than 20 years later, I am a teacher and I am teaching 100% online. I'm like, you know, I put on a collared shirt and I'm wearing pajama pants sitting in my basement, you know, like, so given like Moore's law and the rate of increase that we can and do see across a lot of these technologies, at what point do you think it would be feasible? Obviously costs are coming down, which is a huge help. At what point do you think it would be possible or reasonable, I should say, to actually try to run, say, you know, a high school or maybe even college classes online using virtual reality?
Yeah, that is the golden question that everyone is trying to figure out.
Basically, when do I buy stock, I guess is what I'm saying. No.
But like, well, I mean, you know, the earlier the better. Right. The earlier the better, I think. You know, like you were saying, it is kind of a not an if, but a when situation. And, you know, what we're seeing with the pandemic, you know, you're looking at a company like Coursera, for example, raising another $130 million round and their student, you know, growth being explosive as well. And just this clear trend to online as that first step. So I think that, you know, we're starting to already see these early innovative, you know, universities and schools starting to leverage this technology. And, you know, the issue with having a full curriculum in there is that, you know, the hardware is still admittedly a little bit uncomfortable. It's bulky. You know, the input it's okay for specific use cases, you know, but it still has yet to be improved to hit that mass consumer level. You know, we've experimented, you know, last year we were experimenting with social VR classrooms. We've gotten much more into sort of asynchronous, you know, we have this AI tutor that's guiding you through. So that's easier to do in VR in a lot of ways, but we were experimenting with social settings where basically we would take content that was pre-existing curriculum, because there's all this source of truth, all this knowledge and curriculum that exists. And that's one of the huge issues with VR is translating that into the experience, because it's so heavy and time consuming. But what we were experimenting with is taking those lectures, literally PowerPoints, videos, photos, and bringing them into an immersive space. And we would create what we'd call a learning journey. So you would take, let's say there's 10 slides in the presentation, you would place those slides around the virtual space. Maybe it's a park, maybe it's a museum or a gallery style space. And then the students actually virtually physically move together through that space, going station to station, learning the content, having that supplemented by having three-dimensional models in the space, having, you know, floating screens with the videos. And we found that to actually be very, very engaging. And, you know, one of the big issues with remote and online learning is that students, you know, the plague of the phone, right? And notifications and constantly being bombarded by this information where, you know, it's really hard to stay focused in that environment. And in VR, for now, until all the social applications are integrated and you start having like a Twitter bird fly into your world and stuff.
until we pollute that space as well, right?
Yeah, I'm like, this is a golden window for VR in terms of not being polluted by that type of stuff. But, you know, when right now, you know, you can have these hyper-focused experiences where students feel like they're together. They can be anywhere in the world, but they can literally hand a virtual object back and forth. Like we ran a course focused on CPU optimization for programming. It was a more senior level thing. And we actually brought three-dimensional, you know, CPUs into the space and people were looking at them and handing them back and forth. And I had this little moment in there during that time. It was like, this really is the future. Like, I think this is really, really going to happen. And, you know, that was right before we had a bunch of network errors and people started crashing out of the system and couldn't hear each other. And so, you know, it is early still, but it's incredibly promising. And, you know, where it's going is just so inspiring. I mean, I always like to think about how, you know, a 10-year-old kid, for example, might be able to jump into a quantum physics, you know, simulation, or jump into a theory of relativity experience and actually, you know, be at the center of these experiences and witness them and embody them and understand at a fundamental level what they mean versus memorizing a formula, for example. And so that just makes me just ever passionate about this and just, you know, yeah, to tie it in. I know I'm kind of just going off. I'm really excited.
It's perfect. And I actually love everything you just said, because that is almost exactly how I got onto this idea. Is, you know, like I've had a conversation here and there, you know, oh, you know, virtual reality is cool. My brother-in-law got one of the, I forget who made it. It was one of the headsets that one of those like Samsung phone a few years ago. And, you know, we played around with it and I was like, oh, it looks cool. But yeah, what am I really doing with this thing, right? But it was maybe, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, something like that. I finished online classes. Like it was going to lunch and it just hit me. I was like, man, it would be so much better for these kids if they felt like they were in the classroom. And I'm not even the biggest fan of the classroom, right? Like, I mean, I'm a teacher. I like school in general, but I don't think that it's a perfect institution by any means. But I know that right now there's a lot of people who like just want some things to go back to normal. You know, there are parents who are just screaming at school boards, just let my kid back in the building. You know, even though a year ago, those same people were screaming, you're all idiots and you're not teaching my kid anything. Like now everybody wants back in. And, you know, we finished the class and we just had this discussion. And I thought, you know, that would have gone so much better if they at least felt like they were in the room. And that's, and like, I was like, you know what? Like, in theory, we could do that. Like they could put on a headset and look left and see the one kid and look right and see the other kid. And I think a lot of them would be more comfortable opening up and having the conversation. Like right now we see, my classes are pretty good about it, but across the board, you see a lot of kids with cameras off, not really wanting to participate in discussion. Something about this different environment just changes the way they participate. You know, and I was like, yeah, why couldn't we just have like a virtual classroom where you can have the social interaction? Because even if we go back to like hybrid teaching right now, because of the social distancing limitations put in place by the state, they're not going to be able to hand papers back and forth. So when I say trade a paper with your neighbor and review the work, we're not doing that. They're still going to have to do it all through our learning management system and trade it virtually. So even if they go sit in the room, they're still going to be doing so much of this online. I was like, man, if we could just do this in virtual reality, they could at least feel like they were handing the paper off to someone else and still do this whole thing. And then, I mean, there's a history teacher in my school who he's fantastic. And I keep trying to get him on the podcast because he's a football coach. He's a history teacher, really busy guy. And he's doing what he calls Coach Curtis's History Roadshow or something like this. And literally he has it planned for the whole school year. He has different important sites, like historic sites in American history. And every week he and his like elementary school age daughter are hopping on a train or they're taking a road trip. And he goes like live on Instagram and he puts it up on TikTok. Like he's everywhere. And basically the kid's class for that day is you get to go on a field trip with him and he walks around and tells you all about the stuff. And it's cool. And the kids all watch it. He has kids who aren't in his class who show up to watch it. Just they think it's cool. And I was like, man, why would I bother recreating the classroom if we could just like recreate the field trip, right? And so I put a tweet up about it, something else. And I think you actually liked it. And that was the thing where I was like, okay, cool. Cause I'd already been thinking I should talk to somebody about it. And so I looked you up, a couple other people, and I was like, yeah, like I think this might be the guy because you're specifically working in the virtual reality industry within the education space. And I was like, oh, this is perfect, right? So what you just described about trying to recreate that setting, whether it's a museum, a gallery, a classroom, whatever it may be, is exactly where I was when I was thinking like we could be doing this better. And the technology exists. It's just, it's not quite ready yet, you know? So I guess let's hit one of the main questions here just to figure out how we got to this point, because I'm just a guy who thinks too much and I'm also not in a position to implement any of this. Right? I mean, you know, I can talk about it and promote it, and that's the extent of my influence, at least at the moment. But for you, what did you do in school that led you to working in technology and working in, you know, VR, AR, et cetera? Like what did you do in school, like college, high school? What kind of student were you? What did you like to study? What did you hate to study? Like what's your educational background?
Yeah. So I grew up in Boulder, Colorado. And I actually started off in Montessori and Waldorf school when I was really young. So we like to joke that I learned how to finger knit before I learned how to read. It was, you know, I think that foundation was actually one of the most influential academic experiences that shaped my perspective, because I think, you know, was very constructivist, was very, you know, create your own way, find something that you're passionate about, go in all, you know, full in on it. And, you know, I was very fortunate to have a supportive family that was always, you know, encouraging me to follow my passions. And I really, you know, traditional school, I was not, you know, I wasn't the best student. I wasn't super engaged in the classroom. You know, if there was a subject that I was passionate about, I would get very competitive and, you know, fight for that top grade. But in general, you know, it just was, I was uninspired, I guess you could say. And, you know, that was a huge reason why I'm so passionate about education and helping to create inspiration in the classroom, because these subjects are incredible. Learning about chemistry, learning about biology, like the fact that we can have access to this knowledge and the fact that we know what's happening now after, a whole span of existence where
99% of the history of your species, nothing, and in the last 200 years, you start figuring it all out. Right. The engagement piece is huge. And I have some friends who did Montessori, Waldorf, things like that. And a lot of them actually say similar things to what you just did, that they got very good at doing the things they were into doing. And they found themselves generally uninspired and unengaged by the other stuff, And so that might be sort of the double-edged sort of it. Like, I think in a broad sense, it's probably a good thing in terms of the game of school and getting your GPA and getting into college. Sometimes that might hold some people back. Did you have an interest in technology when you were, say, in high school, middle school, high school? Like when you were younger, was this something you were already into, or did that come later?
Yeah. So when I was about 8, I started to get really into computers, and, I was constantly on the website Newegg, and I was, constantly looking at the benchmarks of the Intel versus AMD Pentium processor and, just really diving into that whole world, and, was really into all the early cell phones and just gadgets and, also into cars and just mechanical things I was really fascinated by. And as I, as I grew up a little bit, and then I got into fifth grade, I started to get really into music. And so my passion, my focus sort of shifted away from all this technology stuff. Whereas, before I was literally building computers and, hacking around and, playing with early HTML, and nothing too serious on the programming side. But yeah, my focus really shifted over to music, and I, became really serious about drumming and, production and things of that nature. And then when I tried VR again, I got into web development, and I was programming again and more on the design side, like front end. But when I tried VR, it was like, this is it. It was that aha moment that just brought everything full circle. And yeah, I do definitely attribute, that early education to, opening my mind to the possibility of, pursuing this type of career and just going all in and just, being willing to pursue this technology that back in the day was just developer kits, no consumer hardware. And I'm really grateful for all of that.
Yeah. So, it having early interest, I think, in anything helps. Because if nothing else, it gives you a head start, right? I'm already into it. I feel good about what I'm doing. You can start young, and that's a nice way to be. But I don't know that everyone in any job necessarily does that. Is this what you did, coming out of high school? Did you go to college? If so, did you study this stuff, or did you go straight into the industry? What happens for you after you leave high school?
Yeah. So basically I knew that I wanted to study entrepreneurship. That's, for me, has been my lifelong passion, just creating things, creating companies. And I knew I wanted to be in California, in Southern California. So it kind of whittled it down to a few options. And I ended up choosing Chapman and their entrepreneurship program. And I was there for a semester. And at the time I was working on a company, and I was so excited, I'm going to be surrounded by all these professors and I can learn, they can help me grow. And I remember, after being there for a little while and just not really resonating with the structure, and just, I went in to talk to one of my professors and I was so excited. I have this problem I'm facing. I have a potential customer. I'm trying to figure out how to do this. And he said, slow down, man, slow down. You're just a freshman. And I was like, what? What are you? I'm paying 50 grand a year to do this. And so I decided, it was that plus, a number of other things. I just decided, I'm just going to do this. I'm fortunate that I'm in one area, entrepreneurship, where, school, it's probably one of the least important subjects, right? You know, you want to be an entrepreneur.
Then when you said, well, I knew I wanted to study entrepreneurship, and I'm thinking well, that sounds like you should just start a company or get a job. I don't that's not an easy thing to study.
It's, society conditions us. And I was certainly in that place. All my friends were getting into good schools and they were, going to school, and I felt pressured and I felt like I had to do it. And, it's something that, I try to be very realistic when I talk to, younger folks that are looking at, maybe not going to school, taking a year off, You know, I think, you know, school is incredible for some things, right? If you want to become a doctor, of course, you have to go to school. You have to get that formal education. But if you're deeply passionate about something and you have that grit and that grind to just go and, you know, take it on and to also self-educate, I think that's a huge, huge thing that, you know, is often overlooked, is the fact that in the past, you went to a university because that was where the knowledge was. You had to go there to get the knowledge.
Right. Now, the gatekeepers. Yeah.
Yeah. And now we have in our pocket, most of us have access to the world's knowledge instantly. Right. And so that paradigm shift is, you know, I think, again, overlooked in a lot of ways. And, you know, I also realize there are some people where, you know, they need that structure and they thrive in that structure. And, you know, I definitely do not want to discount formal education in that sense, but I do believe that the world is in a different place now where if you are self-motivated, if you're scrappy, if you are persistent, then you can truly accomplish your dreams with just, you know, just diving into what you're interested in online.
Yeah. You know, and I've been saying this for a while. One of the cool things about doing this podcast, I get to talk to so many different people that there's things that I kind of thought before, but I never actually had to say out loud. And, you know, when you have an idea, but you never put it into words, you don't actually have to pick exactly what the idea is. And so I've become a lot more specific. And, you know, and so I always say, you know, the old three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. I like a fourth one. I want rhetoric on there for the critical thinking component. Mm-hmm. If you can walk out of high school with the four R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and rhetoric, I loved college. Like, I don't know if anybody's ever loved college more than me. Like, I went to every class and every party. I didn't sleep for, you know, the whole time, but it was great. But I know it, like, it's not for everyone. It shouldn't have to be. And because we've decentralized that knowledge, like, because it's available to you, not just at your library, but on the internet all the time, if you have the basic skills and the drive, as you pointed out, you can kind of just, you know, do it. And I think a lot of people are seeing that. Like, I talked to one of the sort of the leaders in the gap year movement in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. the value of taking a year off. Actually, somebody you might even have heard of, but Megan O'Connor, she's the entrepreneur in residence at Kaplan. Like, she started a big ed tech company and now works with Kaplan. And her whole vision is that she thinks college is going to sort of disappear in the form it's in, because she says there's no reason you have to go to one college for 4 years. She's like, I think people are just going to start taking two or three classes at one school and three or four at another school. They're going to put together their own education at the schools or with the professors they think are best. And I'm like, man, I was like, I don't know any school registrar that's going to allow that. But I tell you what, it's not a bad idea, because you can make it work for you. You know, and as you pointed out, maybe, you know, college is great, but maybe it's not great for every application or for every job. You know, and I've talked to a lot of people. There's a local tech firm. They do a lot of security work for the federal government. And their CEO, his kids go to went to the schools in the county that I work in. And I remember he said to me that he said, you know, college is great, but some of my best employees I hire right out of high school, because no one has told them that what they're doing is the wrong way yet. So I can just let them do whatever they want to do. And then I slowly... He said, by the time they would have graduated college, they're experts in the field, and I've gotten 4 years out of them at a discount rate, you know, is essentially sort of how he explained it. And so he told me, he goes, you know, I would never tell a kid not to go to college, but I would tell them that if they can get good with programming or certain tech things in school, he's like, I would tell them to skip it and just go make the money, because that's the way. And I thought, you know, that was for me, that was a big conversation, because that was one of the first times I'd ever seriously considered sort of maybe the path that you took, you know. And I now have that talk with students once in a while, like, you know, you do think about what your parents want to say, and college is fantastic, but you may have a skill set or an interest that could be better served in other ways. And, you know, and that's something that you need to explore, with the idea that we can, you know, you have the knowledge at your disposal, in your pocket, and maybe taking, you know, a little bit of the idea of picking and choosing your college classes and things like that. The thing that makes it difficult, obviously, is, you know, having to move school to school, but obviously we can do, you know, most school applications online right now. And the big limitation is in maybe some of the lab classes. You know, if I got to take a chemistry class, or I know a lot of medical students have really been, they've been thrown a curveball, because suddenly, you know, their entire life has been put on hold for a year because they cannot be in the hospital setting. If VR maybe advances a little bit, that bridge might, you know, be there, right? Like, that hurdle might disappear. Do you think that some of these ideas of freeing up education or making college sort of less mandatory, quote unquote, do you think that that's something that your technology or the companies that you're working on could eventually facilitate? Like, is that something you're working on to sort of decentralize education in that way? Or are you trying to sort of give the tools to the traditional institutions?
So it's a really good question. I mean, my long-term goal is to do whatever serves the student. And I think right now the student is not well served getting 100K in debt and coming out of a program where they have a skill set that they could have acquired with 6 months on the job somewhere and gotten paid to do that. Like you said, your friend with sort of that apprenticeship style model. I do think that there's an opportunity for a radical transformation in the structure. And you're seeing these new technologies like blockchain, for example. You know, I think there's a big opportunity in some sort of blockchain-based governance, you know, accrediting system where the same way that when edX was starting, for example, they're like, MIT, we're going to put our courses online for free. Like, that's our core IP. Why would we put that online for free? Right. And now look at the world, right? There's thousands of courses online for free. So I think there will be this paradigm shift where people are sort of just, they kind of have to do it, right? They just have to do it to stay relevant. And, you know, I do think this sort of this blockchain idea of having all sorts of different courses, being able to validate that you've completed those courses, have everything saved on the blockchain, an employer could just go back and look, see, okay, you know, like Ryan completed these 10 courses. He has this done. Like, that's what I care about. That's what I want. And, you know, being able to have transparency into that. Whereas now you hear about people lying about their GPAs, lying about the school that they went to, right? It's, I think there's a big opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, and do you think in that process, do you think that, you know, and again, whether it's in 2 years or 10 years or however long it takes, do you think that virtual reality platforms will increase those opportunities? And I think I read that you taught the first virtual reality class at MIT or with MIT, something like that, right? Like, is that kind of thing? First, you know, tell me obviously if that was not true, but if that's a possibility, then some of the limitations, especially on students that come from a less privileged background, you know, where the travel to school or location becomes a big deal. I mean, in theory, we can remove those barriers and burdens if virtual reality is accessible, right? Or if that's something we can do. Like, is that how that could work in the future to essentially give people sort of the access we're seeing right now with online classes and online school, but to also allow you to do that in the immersive setting so that you can actually take the lab class, not just the lecture course? Like, is that where you think we're going with this?
I do. Yeah. And so with that MIT course, it was with the MIT Media Lab, and there was a group of students that they were learning virtual reality development. So we set up this virtual classroom where they were actually on campus because that's where the hardware was, but they could be anywhere. And I was in California, and we had this virtual classroom that we set up that was kind of this amphitheater style space. And everyone was kind of standing around in the center, and there was a big screen, and we were doing a presentation, answering questions, and kind of walking through all the content together. So it felt like everyone was there together, even though, you know, we were spread apart across the country. And, you know, I think that that model is certainly going to persist and certainly going to grow, especially as the resolution in the headsets continues to rise. The new Oculus Quest is at about 4K, which is now pretty comfortable for reading text. Whereas the older headsets, you know, just, it was still screen door effect is what it's called, where you kind of have the pixelation and it's still a little bit hard to read, but it's getting better and better with every model. There's a company that I'd love to mention called Labster. When you talk about these labs, these, you know, having access to a lab, this company has hundreds of courses. They have virtual labs. You can go in there. I think their tagline at one point was $1 million lab from anywhere virtually or something of that nature. Yeah. And basically you can go in, you have $1 million worth of machinery that, you know, the typical high school student or college student would rarely have access to. And you can go through and simulate all these processes and experiments, and you can learn chemistry and you can learn biology and physics. And there's another company called ClassVR that also has, I think they now have something like 700 lessons, and they cover, you know, all the sciences. They also cover drama and theater and music and, you know, things of that nature. But these things are starting to emerge. I mean, one of my favorite quotes is that the future is here. It's just unevenly distributed. And nice. You know, it is here. I mean, these courses exist, and it's just a matter of awareness, access to the hardware. Because today, you know, you can learn chemistry from the perspective of a cell, right? That is possible right now. And, you know, it's just an interesting thing, because a lot of times the people that are in the virtual reality industry are so blinded to reality. They're like, why, you know, how does everyone not do this yet? How do we not, you know, how is this not out there? But it's really just starting. And, you know, the hardware is getting less expensive. I think this Quest 2 is a huge, huge step up. I mean, $299 for this thing. That's a great piece of hardware that can run all this stuff. So yeah, I think we are headed in that direction, and it's really just a matter of time.
Yeah. And that I love what's the line again? The future's here, but it's unevenly distributed. Is that what it is? I like that. I got to remember that. That's going to come in handy. The first time I ever had any recognition of that, I was in college and I was going out with a girl whose family was much, much wealthier than mine. You know, I grew up very middle class, and she had a Mercedes that had things on it that I thought were like, I'm like, this is like a spaceship, you know? And like, no joke, 10 years later, I have the same stuff on my car and I'm like, oh, I get it. I was poor enough that I had to wait. Like, it was like, I get it, you know? And, you know, maybe that's what's happening a little bit with some of these technologies too. I imagine some of this stuff is already accessible to maybe some universities or private schools, things like that. Maybe public schools in a grant program. I've read, and I don't even know enough about this probably to ask this question well, but from what I understand, that there are, and I don't know if it's a public, you know, grant or if this is private or some sort of partnership, but that there are some like VR XR labs sort of popping up around the country that are open in a way where like different people can access it. It's not like you have to work for this company to come in and use the technology and use the space. And so from what I understand is as those, and you know, I think I'd read like 50, and I'm assuming they're mostly along the coasts, you know. Do you think that that's a way to spread the technology, like to create, I mean, almost like a makerspace, you know, like makerspaces are now popping up in like public libraries and things like that. Like, is one way to get the technology into people's hands? Because if you've never used VR, then you don't necessarily care that you don't have it, right? Like you don't want it until you have a chance to use it and you see the possibilities. Is that something that you think is a possibility to increase the rate of adoption, is to give people places to access it? Like, could we create a VR lab where people can come in and use it like library equipment, right? Is that actually happening? I mean, like I read that very briefly, but would that be a way you think to speed up the adoption by schools or universities or things like that?
Certainly. It's a great point. There's a company called VR First, also XR First. They're sort of going by both brands. They have, I think, 150 university partners and different partners that have VR labs. And they basically have negotiated deals with a lot of them where if somebody wants to come in and use the hardware, they can kind of go through their channel and they can get access to it, which is a huge, huge thing. I mean, you know, when I say $299 is super affordable, that still is, all things considered, very expensive. It's just affordable for, you know, the VR industry, you know, compared to where it was, 10x less expensive than a few years ago. But yeah, I definitely think, especially in, you know, countries where, you know, there's even less access, being able to have, you know, the ability to walk in and get your hands on this, you know, this technology, because like you were saying, it's really difficult to understand what VR is unless you've put on the headset. It's just really nearly impossible to explain to someone what it's like, you know. And one thing I love to mention is they did a study that talks about, they were studying awe, the sensation of awe and wonder, and they used VR as the control to elicit the sense of awe, right? So like, I just love that. I think it's super poetic because it's, you know, it's this thing that you just can't comprehend. So having access to these labs, I think, is really important. And, you know, there are programs that are trying to get this out there. I know that, you know, Oculus, HTC, they're all passionate about making this technology accessible. And so, you know, hopefully as time goes on, there will be a real concerted effort to push it out there, because it really has the ability to flatten access in a huge way. I mean, the fact that you can jump into a headset and now be, you know, quote, I'm doing air quotes, but with someone else, right? Yeah. Being able to have that presence with them, build that relationship, is a huge, huge thing that, you know, I think is really going to flatten the world, especially when you start getting into automatic translation of language and people that are, you know, speaking Spanish are now able to just directly have it translated into English and vice versa. And now you have this like cross-border communication that it gets really interesting. And, you know, going way back to your first questions of, or one of your first questions around when is this going to happen? you know, I think within 10 years, absolutely will be happening. And the technology that's already in these labs, you know, in companies like Facebook and Microsoft and Apple is incredible, right? They've just released what's at a consumer price point. But when you start to think about where this goes 5 years, you know, the real vision that I think a lot of the industry holds is this idea of XR glasses. So maybe this is a good time to jump into those definitions.
That's
perfect,
dude. That's exactly where I was going. The next thing I was going to say is maybe we should define these terms because we've been talking about this. So go, I'll let you do the work here because you are obviously the expert. But yeah, what XR, AR, MR, VR, and a dozen other terms that what the hell are we talking about?
Yeah, it's such a like joke within the industry how it's like, let's go to the VR, AR, MR conference, right? And then finally, you know, people are like, no, we need one term that can just cover all of these things. And so that term is XR. So as XR was coming online, there was sort of this dispute of, is it variable X reality? Is it extended reality? Like, what is XR? But basically, the common understanding now is that XR is essentially a catch-all term for any immersive technology. And so immersive technology has a spectrum. So if you think about on the far left of the spectrum, you have augmented reality. And you can think of augmented reality as being in a real physical space and just having a few things augmented, right? So it's at 95% real, 99% real, 1% digital augmented. And then you have this spectrum all the way from the left of augmented through to the right side, which is virtual reality, fully immersive, where every single photon that you see, every single piece of information that's coming in is digital. So there's this whole spectrum that exists, which you could refer to as the XR spectrum. So, you know, MR is a term that's thrown around as well. MR kind of sits in the middle of the spectrum. So, some people call it Microsoft reality because they.
So when I floated that I was going to have this conversation to one of my classes, you know, and the kids got into it, and I explained my knowledge like this. I was like, I think I know more than the average person, but far less than a person who's probably qualified to do this discussion really well, right? But as I was thinking about these terms, I think most people were familiar with Google Glass a few years ago, got popular. They ran into some problems, both just, I think, in the technology itself, but also people maybe not using it responsibly, and they pulled it off the market. That would be more your augmented reality, like a clear pair of glasses that scrolls information on the screen, say over one of your eyes, right? To virtual reality, where when you put the goggles on, it's black, you know, it's a solid set of goggles. You cannot see through them. And then MR would be in between, like sunglasses. Like, I was trying to think about this, like, what's the right analogy? And maybe it's like the clear Google Glass with something scrolling to sunglasses to blackout goggles where everything is. Like, is that a fair way to describe the way you're going to be seeing this? Because in MR, right, you're looking like, I'd be looking around in the room I'm in, but some of the things I'm actually seeing would be digital, like wouldn't be in the room. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because some people would argue that that's augmented reality as well. So
okay,
the thing with Google Glass that I think, you know, may have led to their fate essentially is the fact that it's more of a heads-up display. It's like having a little screen on your face, whereas with augmented reality, there's typically a technology called SLAM, which is simultaneous localization and mapping. And essentially what that does is it uses computer vision to analyze the space around you. And it could say, this is a desk, this is the floor, this is a chair, right? And it can see the different, sometimes it can classify the objects, but typically it just sees a plane. And then you could put in augmented reality, you could put a virtual, you know, cup on the table and it would actually stick there in the place. So when you move the phone around or when you move the glasses around, it's actually updating the image so that it sticks into that place.
Is this like, I think it's like IKEA has like a design thing, right? Where you can, is that what it is? Like, cause I know in IKEA that they have a thing where like you can pull up a picture of a, you know, a bookshelf on your phone and then hold it and look around your house. And if you're looking through your phone screen, you could see the bookshelf in all the locations in your house. Like, is that kind of what we're talking about?
Yeah. So that would be considered an augmented reality app.
Okay.
To my knowledge, to my definition. And, you know, IKEA was a major innovator and they were, you know, they were right there. They were pushing it. They were one of the first to really come out with a really polished application. And that's a great example of how typically to understand spatially how some large, heavy, expensive, cumbersome thing might fit into a space, you'd have to, you know, get it there, maybe build it out of cardboard or sit there and use your imagination, right?
But, draw 10 pictures until,
yeah, have your kids sit there and sit in the corner, right? Or whatever it is, right? But basically with augmented reality, you can put that virtual or digital object into the space, and then using SLAM, you can, as you move, it's automatically calculating the perspective of that object. So if you move far to the right, now you're seeing the right side of the bookshelf. If you move to the left, now you're seeing the left side of the bookshelf. So that's where the power of this technology really comes in, because you're mapping the digital onto the physical. And so that's, you know, that's what I think is, that's where we're all, you know, super excited in terms of these XR glasses that can cover the full spectrum. That, you know, I like to talk about responsive XR design. I think this will be, you know, a thing in the future where you have your glasses, they have six cameras on them, they have all sorts of sensors, all sorts of microphones. And as you walk into a space, it uses the computer vision to build a three-dimensional model of the space, analyzes what's there, and then takes the application and displays it responsively, the same way that you might have like a mobile website that can scale up to a desktop website.
Right.
It will display that information intelligently and responsively. So if you're at home, if you're sitting in your office and you want your full workstation virtually, then you can be fully immersive. You could be sitting on the moon with a, you know, 50-inch monitors in front of you doing your programming, doing whatever. And then when you get up and you walk out, then it goes and shrinks down into the top right. And now you just have your news feed and your Twitter feed that's in your space or whatever you want to have with you. So I think that's where this technology gets really interesting. And we still haven't had that iPhone moment. We still haven't had that, you know, initial, like desktop computer moment where that hardware exists. And it's just, it's culminating from both sides of the spectrum and eventually will converge into one device that can cover that entire spectrum. And
yeah,
there's a lot of speculation over when that will happen, but you know, Facebook is working on that. Apple is working on that to our knowledge. And you know, Microsoft is already out with the HoloLens, which is a pretty fantastic device. It's still large, but the HoloLens can deliver a really beautiful, you know, they call it mixed reality experience, which again is like XR. It's like, you know, there's all these terms, but you know, the technology is there. It's just, it's like the equivalent of back in the day, the cell phone briefcase where, yeah, you know, you have to carry that around instead of having your Nokia flip phone. So yeah, just early days.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think the first time in my life that I ever considered this, I was in elementary school and I was in like a, I was in like a gifted pullout program, and they would just give us like weird things to do sometimes, like just learn about this stuff. And sometimes we did it, and sometimes it was just, you read an article and, you know, and I don't know why this one stuck with me. Like, you know, of all the hundreds of things we read about or did, like, this is one of my clearest memories, and it was probably like third grade, but at MIT, they had a competition where students were creating wearable technology. Like now it would just be your cell phone. Like it was so much weaker in terms of its power than what you just already have in your pocket today. But students were building a wearable rig, and almost everyone started with like some version of a bike helmet or like a hard hat. And it had like a little CPU processor and all this stuff, and like a little like set of sunglasses. And the deal was, in whatever the program was, that whatever you created, you could wear to all of your classes. And I remember in third grade thinking like, man, it would be so hard to make it. But you would get 100% on every test after that because you have everything you need, like right in front of your eyes, right? You know, and 10 years later, well, yeah, literally probably 10 years later or something, I'm like, oh, well, you know, now 15 years later, we have smartphones and that's not that big a deal. But that leap from the idea that it was so far-fetched that you could have that headgear to now you can do a lot of it in the palm of your hand. It's almost like the move now is like back to make it wearable so I don't have to pick it up. It's just, it's there for me all the time. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe I'm optimistic, and I'm sure that it's easy for you in the industry to get optimistic in the same way, but like, I really don't think it's that far away. You know, like I don't think it's, you know, I was talking to a friend about just the idea of this, and he's like, wow, what do you think, 50 years? And I was like, I think it's way closer than 50 years. I was like, I think it's a question of, are we talking about two? Or are we talking about 10? And I mean, and it could be more than that, who knows? But I don't get the sense that the technology in any way is slowing down. And as some of the companies you've named are throwing resources at it, you know, I think it's probably sooner rather than later. And which means that, you know, for me, my job then is to start thinking about like application. Like if somebody hands me the tool, you know, you got to figure out how you use it, how you use it well. And so what you're doing now with your company Axon Park, right, is looking at how to adapt the technology into usable like training programs, right? And so I poked around on the website a little bit, but I'll let you talk about it. Like, what is the focus? Like, what's the mission of Axon Park? What kind of work are you guys doing where you're taking the XR technologies and actually putting it into training, whether that's in a school or in a private industry? What are you doing in that company now?
Yeah, so our current focus is medical skills training. So frontline healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, and essentially the long-term goal of the company and the reason that it's called Axon Park is because the idea is that it's this virtual campus where it's persistent, it's always there. You can teleport in any time of day from anywhere in the world. And now you're standing in this virtual park where you can explore and you can learn new skills. So it's designed to be similar in theory to a physical campus, right? Where you'd have different buildings where you can learn different disciplines. Of course, we're going to leverage all the benefits of VR to have floating buildings and teleporting through dimensions and all this kind of fun stuff. And it's all built around neuroscience. You know, the name Axon being the part of the neuron that actually sends the signal, where the signal travels down. And so the concept is that you're sort of inside this neuron network and teleporting around and learning these new skills. And we have an AI tutor named Axon. And the backstory of the company is in the not so distant future, the first sentient AI is born named Axon. And Axon takes a look at humanity and creates Axon Park as a place for humans to come and learn new skills and be inspired and be connected to one another. And so we're sort of rolling with this sci-fi narrative and we'll be building that into the experience. But yeah, we're starting primarily with professional physically based skills because, you know, for example, our current module that we've been working on is focused on personal protective equipment for frontline healthcare workers. It's a huge issue, especially right now. And, you know, recent studies have come out even before COVID and the pandemic showing that 90% of healthcare workers are doing this process incorrectly, which is opening them up to serious contamination. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons that they'll end up contaminating their unit or their family. And, you know, it's a huge problem. And so we saw an opportunity to come in there and take this 26-step process, you know, that's, you know, created by CDC and WHO and build it into a simulator where we, you know, we take a lot of, you know, our energy and focus and put it into building very realistic physics-based interactions. So you'll see some of these VR simulators where it says, you know, put on the respirator and you just grab this respirator that's like a brick when you grab it. The strings aren't moving, like it's not reacting. You just put it on your face and it goes, attaches to your face, right?
Done.
And, you know, we are really passionate about, you know, leveraging this technology for what it can truly be, which is a simulation and recreation of reality. So we put a lot of focus into, you know, grabbing the bottom strap of the respirator, which has physics, and actually having to physically pull it and wrap it around your head and mold the nose piece down on your nose. And, you know, we have this system that we call intuition, which is an analytics system, because when you're in VR, you know, all of the movement, all of the time, the, you know, between steps, how you're actually moving, you know, all of that is recorded. It can be recorded. And so we take that information and, you know, we help the learner understand how they can improve, where they might make mistakes, you know, how they, you know, areas that they might be missing, you know, because you can really tell if somebody's being fluid and moving through the space.
How does the feedback loop work on that? Like you can go into the simulator, you can do this and say it's recorded or not. I mean, I don't know which would work better. And you pointed out that a lot of this can be done asynchronously, right? So, you know, you can do the training kind of anytime. Is there like a virtual trainer built in that provides feedback, or are we still at a point where a human being needs to then watch that video to provide the commentary? Like, because like you said, you know, if this goes wrong 90% of the time, then people aren't just making one mistake. Like if people made one mistake, I'm not the guy that can do it, but I assume that you or someone you work with could easily program the corrective feedback to say, here's how you fix that mistake. But in a 26-step process that people screw up 90% of the time, I'm thinking there's a lot of different possible deviations from the recommended path for how to put on the PPE. How do you provide feedback in that setting, or does the feedback come later? You know, how do you do that correction?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that. So basically, we have three modes. So this will maybe give some context to the overarching structure. So once you say, okay, I want to learn the proper process for PPE, that's the course. And then the first mode is a tutorial. So it walks you through every single step of the process. You see a high-res video of a doctor putting it on in the perfect way, and then you actually have to grab it off the table and follow the exact same sequence. Then once you've completed that tutorial, then you go into the training mode, which is gamified. So basically, if you do the wrong thing, you lose points. If you do the right thing, you gain points. And we intentionally designed it so that if, for example, you grab the face shield instead of the respirator, then the whole world flashes red and the AI that's basically just floating there, Axon, says, try another option, right? So you, she doesn't say, this is what you do, right? It just says,
oh yeah. What was that game? It was a terrible game back in the day. They did, it was like Hugo's House of Horrors or something. It used to frustrate so much. The whole thing was you had to move a guy around and do stuff on the screen, but you had to type commands, but it never told you what to type. Like every screen, you'd have to try typing 10,000 different things before you'd figure out how to get out of that screen into the next one. So in this case, like it flashes and it says, try something else. It's really forcing you to use what you learned in the modeled simulation right before it. I watch it, I duplicate it. Now I'm on my own with the guidance, right? So can it actually, when you do that, can that actually get into the actual physical techniques? Like you said, there's a lot of physics in it. Is that more the process of doing the right things in the right order? Or does that get down to the details of how you're actually doing each step? Like what's the level of precision in that feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically it gets down to the specifics of which respirator strap you're grabbing first. Did you actually successfully mold the nose piece over the top of your nose? So it gets into these details that are super important in practice. So basically you have that whole sequence where, you know, Axon is telling you try another option, or it gives you this positive reinforcement sound. And we actually, you know, we blast people with different hertz that are like, the study came out of MIT, and this is all experimental, but the study came out of MIT showing that when you attempt to do something and your hypothesis of what you think is correct is confirmed, then your brain will release like a 25, 30 hertz signal. And then and on the opposite side of that, if it's you think something and then it ends up being wrong, your brain will release like a 3 hertz or lower signal. So we actually blast those hertz out with the correct or incorrect thing, just as kind of a fun thing. But then you finally move into the testing mode, which is where we have the most robust feedback system. And, you know, it's something that we're really proud of that, you know, took a while to create, to the point where if you do one thing wrong out of sequence, the AI will tell you, you should have done this. Right. And then you start from the beginning. And it's this process called rapid cycle deliberate practice, which is a simulation based training methodology where basically you go through, if you make a mistake, you get feedback on what you should have done. And then you start from the beginning. You try again. If you make a mistake, you start from the beginning. So it's kind of like playing one of those old, you know, Nintendo 64 games where if you make one mistake at the very end, you have to go all the way back, which, you know, if you can't make it through, then you're not prepared to do this on the front line. So yeah, that's a huge thing for us, is providing feedback so that it's, you know, our goal is for this to be better than in-person training, because you have, you know, 100% consistency. You're not, you know, maybe an instructor's distracted or tired, or it's a doctor, like during COVID, doctors were being pulled off the front lines and asked to train 60 staff. And it's just, you know, it's really difficult. So, you know, that's a huge aspect for us, is making sure that the learner is getting real good feedback, that they're being forced to recall the information, they're being forced to really like come to the conclusion on their own during the training mode. And then when they're ready for that big test, they do get the feedback of, you know, next time, this is what you should have done.
Right. So. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, that's like, it's, you know, it's one of the hardest things for me as a teacher is the feedback piece. Like I'm, you know, I teach English. I'm happy to grade one paper. It's 76 of them, right? But man, I can run a class discussion. I could lecture you on something. I can shut my mouth and ask a question and let you guys talk about, like, the instructional piece is fun, you know, and I really like that. But the feedback piece is actually, in a lot of cases, the most important. Like, I need to front load information to give you time to work with this. And then I need to give you the feedback. And the feedback's one of the hardest things to do for a person, usually just in terms of it's time intensive, right? My assumption is if you're trying to program all of this to occur in VR or using AI, the feedback's probably also one of the trickier pieces to handle because there's so many variables to work with. I mean, you've thought through that loop, like that communications process loop. You got to complete the circle and the feedback's important. This might be too technical of a question. And if so, you know, feel free to simplify this or politely blow me off if you like. But, you know, thinking about how some of this stuff is actually created in the virtual setting, you talked about how there's a lot of physics to it if you want to do it well. I'm assuming that there's also some degree of art, unless that part is already, you know, AI or already sort of digitized. So like even using the IKEA thing with, you know, hey, put up the bookshelf and move it around. It requires a lot of data to have just the visual piece of it. And so in terms of the people, say, on your team who are actually creating this sort of stuff, how much physics do they need to know? Like, do you employ artists or photographers that are getting the source material that creates the virtual setting? Like, how does that piece happen? And I'm not asking you to literally tell me how, you know, the programming piece of it, but like, what does it take to create a virtual setting for any of this kind of training to occur?
Yeah. So that question is, you know, it's as deep as you want to take it, really. So basically at a foundational level, there are really two primary tools that are being used to create the bulk of the VR experiences that are out there or AR experiences. Primarily, it's Unreal Engine, which is made by Epic Games, who makes Fortnite and all of those games. And then Unity, Unity 3D. And so these are essentially game engines that handle all of the complex math and, you know, all the sort of infrastructure that's required to power a 3D environment. So, you know, you can get some basic physics, right? You can get gravity, you can get, you know, a ball that will bounce, right? You can get a lot of this stuff without really having to write any code. And, you know, that's what's so beautiful about today is that you've got just so many assets. Like Unity has this enormous asset store. So you can, when you're talking about art, they have thousands, maybe tens of thousands of assets on there that you can go and you can download a beautiful environment of a forest and then download characters. And then you can download an AI pack from the store and give the characters life and they'll follow you around. And, you know, like a lot of that stuff is there. So from a foundational standpoint, you know, also, especially in Unreal Engine, they have something called Blueprints, which is visual programming, essentially. So you have this screen that looks like a blueprint, and then you can drag and connect nodes and basically create game logic by just connecting these nodes. And you can do a tremendous amount with just blueprints, never having to even touch the code. But if you want to get really serious and innovate on the specific physics, you know, create, you know, some of these, you know, surgical training companies are getting really deep into this as well, where like you're sawing and it's like, gives you the exact feedback of what the bone density would be. And it's like cutting perfectly. And, you know, you have to get down, you know, into like, you know, C++ if you're in Unreal, C# if you're in Unity, which, you know, is literally like the metal of the processor, right? Like it's not an abstract, it still is abstracted to some degree, but, you know, you're getting really deep into the code. So if you're trying to write something that's, you know, heavy physics, for example, when you're creating a system that does inverse kinematics, this is what it's called. It's basically estimating your arm position or your body position based on where your head and hands are. So, you know, for us, we built an inverse kinematics system. They used to have one that got acquired and then they, like, it just made it inaccessible to people. But like the math of calculating how the arm and elbow and everything should move based on the just vector where your hands of the are. Hand and stuff, yeah. Like that starts to get pretty serious with math. And so, you know, these game engines are built on vector math. You know, that's a light way of saying it because it's, of course, more complex than that. But it's literally, you know, at its foundation, vector math. And, you know, if you can learn that and then you can build on that, then you can do it. But I don't want to discourage anyone that might be listening and interested to get into VR creation because you can just download Unreal Engine for free. You can start pulling in assets for free. And you can build a whole game that works, right? Nice. And like, you don't have to worry about writing code or doing crazy math problems. You can just get right into it.
No, and I mean, and that's great. And I think that that's important that it is accessible, you know, at least at a beginner's level. I just, cause you know, I told you, I don't remember if we were recording or not, but I had said that I ran that by a few students like, hey, you know, we're going to have this conversation. What do you want to know? And a bunch of the questions really got into like, how do you create the setting? How do you create the physics of it? One kid, I mean, I didn't even write down the one guy's question. It was a great question, but I was like, I couldn't track it well enough to write it down. I'm not going to try to ask it, you know, and he was getting pretty detailed into the actual programming side of how we're going to create some of this stuff. I mean, it's incredibly complicated, but maybe it's kind of reassuring to know that there are some parts of this that don't have to be. And I think about that, just thinking about the perspective of, as say a young person, a kid in middle school, high school right now, you know, if we see this as a growth industry, and if we see this as something that can have a major impact, I mean, obviously we've been talking about education, but in a million other ways as well, then what we probably want to do is try to get some of this in the hands of young people as quickly as we can. And if they get comfortable, or as you said, you know, you sort of feel passionate about this, and you get really interested in it, you know, that's great. And that's the kid who's then going to work into the more detailed stuff. But you need to find an entry point, right? And so the idea that you can maybe download some of this free and start at a you know, I'm sure it's still advanced, but a more basic level, I think that's probably really important, not just for the adoption of the technology, but maybe for the advancement of it, because you need young people to have access, and maybe, you know, providing access that is not immediately cost prohibitive and things like that is going to be really important in that growth. I do want to ask you about, you know, your recommendations, but first I've got two questions. One is open-ended and one is a little more specific. I'll do the specific one first, give us a chance to think. So what is the best, and then maybe what is the worst movie about virtual reality or virtual settings, right? Because most people's frame of reference for this, if they haven't used the technology, comes from a movie. And in my experience, some of the movies are entertaining, but the way they depict the technology is trash, right? And then in some cases, it looks a little more realistic. So thinking about like what maybe the average listener would know, you know, what they've learned about this from TV shows or movies, what do you think are the better or worse depictions of virtual reality in popular media?
That is a great question. I mean, there's so many ways to approach the question, because there's the whole angle of the dystopian side, right? There's the utopian and dystopian side to pretty much every technology, like we've seen with social media and addiction to phones and things. So I think there is a tremendous concern in terms of, you know, this technology being really dangerous. And you'll see that with like Black Mirror, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I think on that side, you know, it's pretty... I mean, I think at the same time, it's actually good that these depictions are coming out, because it's raising awareness for the issues. So even though people get scared by it and it might put some people off, I do believe that it's important for these depictions to come out. So I think on that side,
know what you're getting into.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, on the other side, you've got, you know, the tent pole, which is kind of the Matrix, right? Which is, I mean, that's really where this is all likely going, right? Because you just think about it, it started out here. The screen is in front of us. Now it's in our hand. Now it's going to be on our glasses. Then how, you know, it can't get any closer really than that. Contact lenses.
How long before it's just in your head? Yeah.
that's happening. You know, you see companies like, you know, Kernel and Neuralink from Elon Musk, and they just did a big expose, you know, albeit it's still early, but you know, that's happening. And you're seeing these experiments happening in labs where people are actually, you know, they're making progress with brain computer interfacing. And so I think when you think about the consumer style VR that we see today, that we think of Oculus style VR, you know, looking at something like Ready Player One, although, like, you know, a lot of diehard VR people thought the movie didn't really stay true to the book. The book is incredible. It's like a cult classic for VR. I know one of your questions was,
recommendations. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Ready Player One, it's kind of like the cliche book to recommend, but I think there's a reason why it's the cliche book to recommend, because it's such a good depiction, especially for education.
That's good. I actually like to hear that, because that's, I'm teaching, I've got one 12th grade class for the first time. I usually do like all juniors. And that's one of the book options. And so this conversation might be making the decision for me, but I'm like this close to making that one of like the big texts we do this year. So I'm glad to hear that. Cause yeah, I've seen the movie. I've read excerpts from the book, and I've heard that they're very different. I haven't read enough to like fully grasp that, but if the book gives a truer depiction, or is, you know, more, that might be a nice way to do that. Think about the movie. obviously that's maybe a ways off. Is that the kind of thing that we could see? Like, do you think we can hit a point where the idea of like the games they play in Ready Player One as a movie, is that something that's realistic that could happen in the future? You know, like, cause I don't know when I remember, like, I love that you said The Matrix. Cause when the first time I saw that movie, I think I was 20 minutes in to Ready Player One. And all I kept thinking was, oh, so this is what happens 50 years before The Matrix. Like, oh, this is how we get, I get it. Okay. You know? But like, is the depiction of the way people interact in the virtual space there something that we could, you know, potentially see maybe in our lifetimes or shortly thereafter?
So one of the biggest hurdles that the industry is facing is input. And, you know, you have your controllers, you know, I can show you here, like it's the viewers can't see, but you've got these controllers that are sort of these blunt objects, right? You can't, you know, if you reach your fingers out, you know, you can't really feel what's going on. You can get some minor haptics that can simulate it a little bit. You know, there are haptic gloves that people will wear. You know, I've tried a handful of them and, you know, they're just still not at the stage that's really, truly compelling, at least the ones that I've tried. Yeah, I think the way that Ready Player One depicts VR from a just pure visual perspective, I tried this headset a while back called the Varjo, and it's just unbelievable. They call it a bionic display, I believe, and it's in the center. They've come up with this innovation where within the center, about 30 degree reticle point of focus, it's perfect human quality resolution. It was a philosophical moment for me when I tried it, because it was really that glimpse into the fact that this really is going to be possible to have a display that is indistinguishable from reality. So on that side, the Ready Player One sort of experience, again, unevenly distributed, but it's here, right? With like a $10,000 or $7,000 headset. And again, just the center reticle, there's still all sorts of like, you know, stuff to figure out, but yeah, I think input, if you can figure out input, like in Ready Player One, they use an omnidirectional treadmill, right? So like he'll strap into the suit and he's in the full, you know, Tesla bodysuit sort of thing. And then he'll, you know, strap into the treadmill. And then that's what gives him the flexibility to move through the space fluidly. And, you know, that's possible. That's pretty heavy duty for just the average person to have to do that. But yeah, I think that, you know, that world, you know, in the book, which I was so bummed in the movie that they didn't talk about Ludus, which is the planet of learning in this metaverse, in the Oasis. And they just didn't even talk about it in the movie at all, which I was super bummed. But basically they have this vision for this whole virtual learning environment where all the students, high school students, are at their houses in VR and they're teleporting into this virtual planet called Ludus, which is the planet of learning within the Oasis. And they take all their classes in there, right? And they have their avatar body. And, you know, of course, it's like a hyper real sort of, you know, anime style, but still sort of realistic looking depiction of yourself. And yeah, it's just a kind of interesting thought experiment that I think, you know, if people see that, I do think that that's really possible. But that type of VR where you're fully present with your body and like all your senses and you can feel touch and you can do that, that's still a ways off.
Yeah. 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 I mean that, you know, when you use the word immersive, you know, that like, that's, if I'm not careful, like that's where my mind goes. Then I have to remind myself like, that's not what, you know, immersive, you can be immersed in the environment without experiencing 100% of like the sensory input that you would have if you were physically there. Not to say that that would never happen. I just, you know, that might be the piece that we're not there yet on. So is there one that just does a totally inaccurate depiction? Like, is there, I don't know. And that's, I don't have one off the top of my head where I think it's total garbage, but I do see some places where I'm like, that doesn't seem realistic. Is there a movie or like a TV show that you can think of where like, is there a place where it is depicted so poorly where you think that's an unrealistic interpretation?
I mean, the issue is that like, I know a lot of the creators of these shows and content, so I don't want to like talk poorly.
They are all wonderful and you should watch them all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely interesting seeing the different depictions. There was a show that came out recently called Upload, which was funny because there's like Horizon, they call it Horizon in there, which is what Facebook calls their social VR world. Mm-hmm. And so there was all this like subliminal stuff of like, you know, this being the future Horizon. And yeah, I think in there, you know, it was an interesting depiction, you know, and again, who knows what's going to happen. I think a lot of people think of Minority Report or they think of Iron Man as like a good augmented reality example. And I bring those up because I think that's also a whole other thing that we didn't touch on a lot, was sort of this idea of bringing these displays and this information into our world. Cause we've talked a lot more about just the fully immersive VR side of things. But I definitely want to give honorable mention to, you know, Iron Man and Minority Report as just really awesome early, you know, examples. There's this short film called Hyper Reality that is just frightening and exciting and like a weird, you know, if you look it up on Google, you'll find it. But it basically depicts this future that we're living in, where you just have this immersive display on and you've got all these hectic ads. And like, you know, there's this one moment that's really powerful where the system like kind of crashes and reboots. And you go from being in this euphoric, peaceful world with like, you know, nice sounds to being in the supermarket and it turning off and you hear a baby crying and you hear like people breathing heavily and you just get this visceral reaction of being like scared and, you know, like vulnerable. And then it comes back online and goes, right? You're back in this peaceful zone. And it just, I would highly recommend that to listeners to check that out, because it's, you know, it was kind of this thing that went viral within the community as just a depiction of where it might go.
Yeah. All right. So we went through a healthy list there. And so I maybe did that out of order anyway, but are there any others? Let's do the book and movie question. Cause you listed a few good ones. There were a couple there that I was going to ask about anyway. Are there any other books or movies, and it can be related to XR or just things in general you think are interesting that people should check out? What would you recommend for listeners to watch? We got a good list there. I mean, you have a bunch of stuff, but any others that we missed?
I think we hit a lot of them. I mean, some of my other favorite books in the education space, like Make It Stick, really resonated with me. I mean, just learning about learning, right? How to make it stick. And so I took a lot of the learnings from that book and implemented it into these training experiences. So I found that to be really useful. Another series that I love is the Foundation series from Asimov, Isaac Asimov was just so ahead of his time. And, you know, has written, I don't know how many books, like I want to say like 100 books. I might be
totally wrong. Yeah, it might even be more than that. It's a lot.
It's a lot of books. And it's just so cool, you know, reading the Foundation series and, you know, thinking about what it would mean for our species to be interplanetary and where we are potentially in the life cycle of humanity. And I think that's just doesn't really have to do with VR so much, but it just is a really mind-opening book. Those would be kind of the main things to mention.
Good. Yeah, and I mean, and you know, maybe the link between, say, books like that and then some of the XR stuff is if the technology advances to the point that we've been talking about or that appears to be possible, you know, with that comes some really important existential questions about like, what does it mean to live your life? Like, you know, can you really be living your life if you never actually left your basement and did all of it virtually? Like in your head, that's all very real. What is real, right? And I think that's where sometimes you get into the dystopian versions of these stories and maybe a handful of Black Mirror episodes where, you know, and it doesn't mean you certainly don't do it, but I think that maybe we need to be mindful. And so sometimes some of the other sort of sci-fi works raise those same questions about, you know, what does this mean for your humanity? Just because we can do it technologically doesn't mean that we should, or at least we shouldn't jump in too fast before we think it through. And maybe that's an important part of all of this is, you know, smart application is important. You know, the fact that the technology exists does not automatically make it good or acceptable, you know, and I think we've seen a lot of things go bad in some of those ways. So, all right. So this is sort of the open-ended one. And I fully recognize that there's a lot that we could cover, but I also know that you're sort of the guy, right? Like you know, both the VR and how some of this is being applied or will soon be applied in the education space, whether that's looking at, you know, early grades, high school, college, or even at the professional level, just through trainings. What do you think we missed that would be important for listeners to know?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that comes to mind that's just good to kind of understand the difference is in the early days, there was sort of the delineation between 360 video or spherical video or immersive video. Again, a million names for the same thing. And then interactive VR. So basically on one side, you have these pre-recorded. It's basically a video camera that has, you know, let's say six cameras pointing in all directions. It's capturing all that footage. And then you do a process called stitching where you attach at the seams all those images or all those videos rather. And then it puts you inside a sphere of video. And so those experiences are, of course, more photorealistic in a lot of ways because it is real. But you're limited. You can't interact with the environment, right? It's a static experience. So, you know, when a lot of people are getting into VR and trying the headsets, you know, they'll try 360 videos. And that is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to VR. So I want to make sure that listeners understand that there is a big difference between 360 video content and then something that's created in a game engine like Unity or Unreal Engine, where you can actually physically reach out, grab an object, pick it up, look around, climb, you know, crawl on the floor under a table, right? And you have agency in that space. So
when your Facebook feed says enter virtual reality, they're a little bit lying to you. like having that video experience is not entirely what we're talking about.
And that's also, I mean, it's a contested, debated subject, right? Is 360 video VR? Is it not? Right. And I'm kind of in the camp of sure, you can lump it in there, but it's not interactive VR. It's not, another term is 6 degrees of freedom, meaning that you can move basically like up, down, left, right, through on all six axes through the space, and you have your hands and you can reach out. Whereas 3 degree of freedom is basically like if you're a scarecrow and you're stuck on a stick and you can only look around and up and down and side to side. So that is a huge distinction and something that now these modern headsets are, you know, pretty much entirely 6 degree of freedom, which I personally believe is truly VR, because otherwise you're sort of locked into this static, non-interactive space where you can't move around. So yeah, I think that's really, really important. There's also, you know, there's a company called ZSpace that I think is really innovative. They have this tablet, sits in the classroom or learning environment, and you put on glasses that are basically just like 3D glasses like you'd wear at a movie theater, obviously a little, you know, higher end, that have a tracker on them. And as you move on the screen, you see the three-dimensional object and you have this cool sort of stylus type device that you can interact, and it's really, really compelling, and it keeps you in the space with your peers, so you're not fully immersed in VR and like floating off in space. So I think that is a worthy thing to mention. The other thing too that there's so much, but there's some really interesting research that's been done in VR. For example, there was a study that was done where they took a class. They divided the performers of the class into the top third, middle third, bottom third of performers. Then they, again, split them in half, and they had group A go through a traditional learning, right? So lecture-based, you know, reading, watching videos. And then they had the other group go through a virtual reality experience, learning astrophysics, I believe. And the group that went through the VR, all of the students that were even in the bottom tier outperformed the top tier of the other group that learned traditionally. So at the very baseline, the bottom students were above the other top students. So I think that's beautiful to see. The other thing is there was a study that was done where students were embodied in different avatars. So it was Einstein. They were in an Einstein avatar. And it actually showed that people performed better on cognitive tasks when they were in the Einstein avatar body, which is just fascinating. It's kind of like the rubber hand illusion where you have the rubber hand and then someone hits it with a hammer and your whole body contracts, even though your real hand is nowhere near that. So it's, you know, it's really just demonstrating the plasticity of our brain to take on new bodies, you know, and that is just such a fascinating thing to me of, you know, you can jump in an Einstein body and now you're learning more effectively just by doing that one thing.
I get smarter because I think I look smarter. Like that's that's an interesting way to bend perception of self. Yeah. I mean, with that and sort of unrelated, but it was something I meant to ask you earlier. as people adapt to this, right? Like you get a very different sort of sense of yourself in that virtual setting, right? And your senses of what is possible obviously are only limited by whatever program is going on around you. Like, you know, if you want to fly, if you are in a virtual setting that would allow it, you could fly, right? How do you guys handle like VR sickness? Like the motion sickness, like a lot of people experience this at least early on. Is that something that fades over time, or is that something that is like a symptom of the technology itself? As the technology gets better, it goes away. Like if we're thinking about mass adoption, how do you sort of get over the hump of people dealing with sort of, you know, quote unquote motion sickness or VR sickness?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because it's a really important issue that I think, you know, a lot of people are really worried about that. So historically, the early headsets were running at such a low frame rate and they had such high latency that it would just rock your vestibular system, your inner ear, because there was just such a disconnect with what you were seeing and how your body was moving. Recently, the new headsets have much higher refresh rates. So basically it's, you know, the new Oculus can push, I think, 90 hertz. And so once you're getting up to 90 hertz a second, which is basically the screen is refreshing 90 times every second, like motion sickness drops way, way off the grid. And, you know, of course, some people will be impacted still, but it's gotten so much better, right? And there are three main factors that cause cyber sickness or motion sickness in VR, which is essentially the latency. So when you turn your head, how quickly does it process that and update the image based on that movement? The second thing is the update rate, the refresh rate or the hertz of the experience. So once you get, and again, this is kind of, it's contested. There's some research out there. It's kind of like once you're over 70 hertz, 72 hertz, you're relatively good. If you're at 90 hertz, you're great. 120 hertz, you're like, feels like butter. And then the final thing is movement through the space. So, you know, early on, people like the roller coaster experience where you're like, you're experiencing acceleration and you're going faster and slower. Like that just rocks people's world. Whereas if you just have linear acceleration and you're like, if you just go from 0 to 100 miles an hour with no acceleration, basically, and you're just now constantly at 100, then that also reduces cyber sickness significantly. It's just the acceleration, the way that your brain looks to the, your head looks to the left and it doesn't update quickly enough. It's kind of like breaks your inner ear sort of.
Right.
And so, yeah, those are the key issues, and they've been largely ironed out, to be honest. I mean, okay. I used to hear about cyber sickness constantly. People would come out of VR. It was like 30 or 40% of the time people would come out and be like, oh, I feel nauseous. And now like, I never really hear anyone say that.
Okay. Yeah. And what made me think about it was when you said about the Einstein, sort of like the skin, like in the Avatar, and it changes your sense of self. And then I was thinking like, man, you know, that's so weird to really feel like you're in a different body, like in that setting. But when you're in that body, you still have to move around. And so you process it all differently. And I know that's at least one of the concerns that I've heard. And I mentioned my brother-in-law had one of the headsets that, like, you know, he went with his phone or whatever. And he said the reason he didn't use it more was because it always made him nauseous. He'd play with it for a little while and then be like, and I feel like I'm going to vomit. So I just take it off. And he goes, he goes, it was cool, but I don't know if I ever really got my money's worth out of it, because I could never wear it long enough to really do anything with it, you know? And I said, maybe it's because I was just messing with him. I said, maybe it's because you had a crappy headset, but maybe that was true. I don't know.
I mean, a lot of people, when those, you know, Google did this huge thing, 1 million cardboards shipped out. They sent it out with the New York Times Sunday edition, I think. And they just, like, you know, 1 million people got the cardboard headset. And at that point you would take your phone, you know, it could be iOS or Android, you pop it into this thing, and you're now looking inside it, kind of like one of those old ViewMaster sort of things. And that was, you know, again, widely contested in the industry. Like, is it good to have this, or is it detrimental to what people's expectations are of VR? Because again, like looking through especially cardboard headset, which we're grateful that it was cardboard. So it set that precedent. Like, this is just like a, you know, it's a cardboard thing. Yeah. But using the phone and not having 6 degrees of freedom to reach into the experience or be able to walk through the experience, you know, it's a very different world, you know, to what these newer headsets are. So I'd encourage listeners to really look at it with fresh eyes. Like the Oculus Quest 2 is an amazing device. You know, the cyber sickness is way, way less, you know, than, you know, I don't want to throw out a percentage of how many people, but it's probably single digit, if that. And Yeah, you know, it's a good question though, because a lot of times that'll come up. You know, I get nauseous, I get car sick, I don't think I can do VR. But, you know, if you're doing an experience where you're stationary in VR and it's one-to-one movement and you have a good headset, you're probably going to be all right.
Nice. I mean, again, I don't mean to throw at you anything else, because I could just keep saying that we could be here for 6 hours, and that's not the goal. We're going to wrap up here in a minute, but just thinking in terms of the education applications, like, is there anything that you feel like, you know, say for the teachers who are listening, or, you know, parents who are thinking about, oh, I got a young kid, by the time they're in high school, maybe, like, is there anything that you think they should be aware of or thinking about as some of this technology becomes more accessible? I know we already covered a bunch of that, so you can just be like, nah, we did that. But I am very optimistic about application. And so part of the conversation is like hoping people hear it and that raises some awareness, because I'm really hoping this becomes a thing we get to do soon. You know, is there anything you think we missed in that sort of, you know, section of the conversation, or you think we did that okay?
Well, I think from a practical perspective, if, you know, right now, so many people have smartphones in their pocket, right? So augmented reality as the first step, right? Being able to download an app onto your phone and pull it out. And then if you're learning about, you know, biology, having a floating heart that's beating in front of you, and you can hold your phone up or a tablet and you can move the phone. And like I was talking about with the SLAM technology earlier, it stays in place. You can really look around it as if it's sitting there on the table. So I think that's a really easy point for people to start. And, you know, there's a lot of free applications. You just go on the App Store and type in augmented reality and you'll find a bunch of options. And so that's a really great place to start. The other thing I would say is, as you're starting to introduce it to the classroom, because again, like you're saying, when is it going to be a full school that's fully in VR? That still is, you know, a ways off, but being able to give people a blast of one experience, right? Like there's Nefertari's tomb that was photogrammetry to scan this tomb in Egypt, and it's unbelievable. It's gorgeous. And you go in there and you can actually be in the tomb and you feel like you're there. So using it as a supplement to teaching about history, right? If you're learning about Egyptian history, just spend, you know, get a couple headsets, have the kids go in there, look around, have that experience so that they really connect with the material, and then they can come out and have a dialogue and discuss, and you don't have to worry about having everyone be in VR for a long time and have this whole thing. It's really a great tool to just shift someone's perspective, even momentarily, because I've seen people that will try, you know, that the headset that your brother had, the Gear VR, you know, putting that on and being on this, like the Mars rover images, and being on the surface of Mars and looking around and seeing, you know, the galaxy above them, and just that changes them forever, right? Like they felt like they've been to Mars and they've had that experience. So even if it's 30 seconds of exposure to some of these things, that can really ground the content and potentially hook someone who might not be passionate about science or astrology. It might hook them. And now they've had that hook. Now they're interested and they're engaged with the content. So yeah, I wouldn't overestimate the ability for just short blasts. And also, you know, Facebook and the headset providers, I think it's still 13. They say you shouldn't use the headset unless you're 13, which, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily follow that rule.
Right.
I can't endorse that, obviously, but you know, if someone were to use the headset at a younger age, I think just limited blasts of exposure to just put you into a new perspective where it's, oh, that's what a cell looks like, right? Or, oh, this is what it's like a human heart looks like from the inside, or huge, right? Or whatever it is. So yeah, I think that would be sort of the initial starting point. And then finally, I would say, you know, if people are interested in learning how to create VR, that's a great place, you know, to get people interested in technology and in creation and, you know, constructivist learning. You can build things. So again, that Class VR company, they have some good options. You know, Adobe has Aero. You can get like the Curascope app. You can, you know, if you want to get really serious, you can get Unity or Unreal Engine, and which are accessible for people. You just need a pretty good computer to run it. So yeah, I know that's a lot. I don't want to.
No, that it's awesome. And part of it too is, you know, some of what you were just saying about the little, you know, sort of the blasts for younger people. You know, I think about how much time I spent in elementary school playing the Oregon Trail on like the one of the two Macs in the back of the room. And they're always like, well, you're learning about pioneers. But like the reality was I was getting comfortable using a computer and the idea that this is just, this is a tool that we have and we're going to use, so that when it became something that everybody could have in their house, it wasn't like a shock, like I know how to do it. And so there might be some value in having even just, like you said, two headsets that kids get to use, just the idea that you get comfortable with it, because if we're confident this is something that's going to become more, not less popular, then having even limited exposure in the classroom is not only good for your learning experience, say looking around the tomb, but it's also good for your learning experience of learning to understand and how to use this technology, so that if it comes into your life later on, it's something you already know a little bit about, you already know some of the basic applications. You know, I remember people saying like, oh, they just play games on those computers. It's so stupid. And now I'm like, everything we do is on a computer. And I'll be honest, that was how I got comfortable with this, you know? And so it's probably not a bad thing to give at least some exposure that way anyway, you know, even in the limited application. So, all right, we're going to wrap this thing up, but I made what I think is either a good guess on your beliefs or a terrible error in my own podcasting. My most important question is, what is your ideal school? But we spent a bunch of time talking about Axon Park and the AI and all that, and I got into it and I halfway checked it off of my list and I was like, well, that's it. And then I realized it's like, I didn't actually ask. I just assumed, maybe incorrectly, that that is your ideal school. Is your vision for Axon Park, when fully developed? I mean, fully, you know, a project like that is never really done. But, you know, when you have sort of all the features and say the campus buildings running, is that what you think of as the ideal school? Or if I say, you know, right now you could have any school you want in the world, make it anything you want, would you do something different, more like a traditional school? Or is Axon Park really what you believe is the ideal educational setting? Maybe not for everyone, but for your school, the school you get to run, is that what you would do?
So again, this is a complex question because the goal with Axon Park is to make the training content and learning content super accessible to people, regardless of geography, regardless of the language that they speak. And so I think ultimately it still is very, very difficult to replace in-person learning where you're connecting with other people. I believe that, you know, right now, the best possible solution is probably a small classroom size where technology is used to inspire and engage the students and to give them these blasts of an experience to provide real-time feedback and then still have the human instructor. I don't think that we should replace human instructors. Like, and that's
so I'm safe for a little while. Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a thing, right? Because there will be, you know, financial incentive to cut the cost, right? And I know that it's hard to say, but, you know, just strictly financially speaking, having that pressure. But I think that having a human instructor is so important for these students who want to actually be humans in the world, understanding each other, and that the teacher can play an incredible role as a mentor and as a facilitator and as someone that's helping to cultivate emotional intelligence with students and someone that can be sort of that mentor that they look up to. And then leverage the power of these tools to give hyper-personalized experience to each student where they can go off, they can have their own self-directed learning, and then sort of come together and collaborate. So I definitely, you know, I wish I could say, yeah, I think that Axon Park is the end-all solution for everything. And I mean, who knows where it will go, but I don't think that we can overvalue, you know, the human connection piece and how important that is to just develop as a human being and to, you know, be comfortable in social situations and to cultivate, like I was saying, emotional intelligence and to feel a sense of belonging and a sense of self. And so, yeah, it's a very, very complex thing, but I do believe that, you know, we need to really be looking at education in a way where we're teaching kids how to be resourceful with the tools that they have rather than just trying to, like, you know, rote memorization, just forcing information into their brain versus teaching them methods, inspiring them, getting them active and creative. I think we just would see way more powerful outcomes. And it's kind of, you know, like the Ad Astra school that, you know, Elon was experimenting with, which I guess now has like evolved into a full school called Astra Nova or something. But, you know, just basically allowing the kids to, you know, go and explore what makes them passionate, get hands-on with technology in a lab, you know, go and actually run experiments and just be free to do that. And, you know, having the oversight of thoughtful, caring, nurturing instructors and teachers that are there as like a, you know, a guide for them. So yeah, I hope that kind of
No, it's great. It's great. Like I said, it's the most important question I ask, and I almost skipped it because I was so engaged with like thinking about the possibilities of Axon Park and, you know, and that kind of application. But I think you're right. You know, a lot of the things that are most memorable for most people's school experiences were not the things that you actually were taught. You know, I tell people all the time, 50% of the most important things you learn in school, you learn in the hallway, the cafeteria, or on the bus. And, you know, those maybe aren't things that are easily replicated. And I do like that in your answer, I maintain at least a little bit of job security in it, you know, my role as a teacher. But you always want to have better tools. But I don't think any sound craftsman goes to a job site with the goal of using a particular tool on that day. Like the goal is to create something that's meaningful or that's valuable, that's useful, and you use the tools that are necessary to do that. I think that sometimes we put the cart before the horse, and if the goal is just to use the tool without any clear idea about what the intended outcome was going to be, then maybe we've misaligned our values. And I think that maybe that happens, unfortunately, often in school. You know, we get a new website, a new toy, a new book, and everybody said, use it, use it, use it. And it's like, well, use it, but, you know, make sure you know why. And I think, you know, remembering purpose is important in all of this. Taylor, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. I know you're a busy guy and you're working in a really interesting and fast paced field. So taking a little time to sit down and talk is an awesome thing. And I appreciate it. I'm going to remind everybody. So we're talking with Taylor Freeman, who is the founder and CEO of Axon Park, the co-founder of Upload. He was, I don't think I went through a whole resume, right? You were named Forbes magazine 30 under 30 not too long ago, and has also been involved in a lot of different aspects of the XR and VR space. And I hope that some of the people listening got some cool ideas about how some of these technologies can be applied to education and maybe to everyday life. And we have a lot to look out for because I think we're going to see a lot more of this in the near future. Taylor, thank you again for taking the time to hang out and talk.
Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for putting this content out there. It's a really thoughtful podcast that you have and really important content for people to be thinking about. So I'm super grateful to be able to share, and I hope that people got value. And if people have questions, I mean, I would love to support and, you know, help VR get out there, not even related to Axon Park, just, you know, helping teachers find good resources, connect into the industry, you know, get the things that they need to get going, because it's here, it's ready to go. So I'm totally happy to do that if anyone is interested.
Awesome. And I'll post up some links to your website and to some of the social media again. So this has been episode 46 of the ClassCast podcast. We've been talking with Taylor Freeman. You can access this podcast on all major streaming platforms, plus at classcastpodcast.com. Thank you very much.